Hi, welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 82 for March 11th, 2007. Coming up in a few minutes.
I'd say now it's about 70% of science, but it's still 30% of an art, of deciding. It's like the artist who just knows which colours to put together and the other people who don't. So it's about 30% of that still. And certainly in blending there is. In blending there's a gut feeling for what's going to go with something else.
That's Dr. Jim Swan, and while you may not have heard much about him, he's one of the most highly regarded distillery consultants in the whiskey industry. He's worked with dozens of distilleries on ways to make their whiskey better, and we'll get his insights later. First, though, let's look at the news. There's a new development in the whiskey war between the European Union and India. Now the United States is joining the Europeans in opposing India's import tariffs for whiskey and other spirits. U.S. trade officials have lodged their own complaint with the World Trade Organization, charging that India uses tariffs of up to 550% to protect domestic wine and spirits makers from foreign competition. If the tariffs come down, U.S. wineries would probably benefit the most, but bourbon distillers also want a crack at the Indian market. Also on the legal front, and as expected, the Scotch Whiskey Association is appealing a Canadian government ruling that Glenora Distillery can continue to use the Glenbretton name for its single malt whiskey. Earlier this year, Canada's Trademark Opposition Board shot down the SWA's complaint that Glenbretton implies that Glenora's whiskey comes from Scotland. That ruling said while many Scotch whiskey distillers do use Glen in their name, there's no evidence that Canadians associate the word exclusively with Scottish-made spirits. As I've reported here before, Glenora does not use the word Scotch anywhere in the whiskey's packaging, and the bottle and box both carry a large red maple leaf for emphasis. I'll keep you posted as the appeals process continues. Finally, we can talk about whiskey for a minute. Last time around, I mentioned that Chivas Brothers is releasing a new 16-year-old expression of its Longmorn single malt. More details are in now, and the 16 will replace the current 15-year-old Longmorn sold in many markets. The 16 will also get a new bottle design and packaging to show it off as a super premium single malt with a super premium price. While the Longmorn 15 goes for around $50 to $55 in my area, Chivas wants to sell the Longmorn 16 for about £50, or just under $100. Tickets are still on sale for what may well be the largest whiskey festival in the U.S. The Whiskies of the World Expo in San Francisco usually draws more than 4,000 whiskey lovers every April. This year's edition is April 14th, and I talked with festival organizer Rhiannon Walsh about the new whiskeys making their first appearance at the Expo.
Yesterday, I was just putting together the pour list, which I always do to give to our retailer just before the show. And some of the stuff that I was going over was so exciting. You know, I had jotted it down. Of course, I cannot find it right now, but there were a couple things that really stuck out. The independent bottlers in particular have some new things that are just sounding so delicious. I can't wait to try them. Gordon Wright's new Alchemist line is going to be launching at the show this year. And anybody who knows Gordon's background with Mary McDavid, Brooke Lottie, Springbank, knows he's always got something amazing brewing. And this new line is not just single malts. It's Calvados and Armagnacs. And there's stuff in the single malt division of it, though. There's some amazing stuff from Springbank, Brooke Lottie, Highland Park, and the Macallan. And that just sounds just really exciting and delicious. There's Richard Lombard's whiskeys are coming in. They've just come into the country, so we'll have Pebble Beach and his full line as well. And I don't think, well, nobody has seen Gordon's stuff, and maybe just a very few people have come in contact with Richard's because it's been in importation for just a few months. But that's just sort of the tip of the iceberg. There's just some great stuff lined up.
And I have tried Richard's Pebble Beach, and it's quite good.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Now, have you tried any of his Lombard whiskeys?
No, I haven't.
Those look really interesting. And then he's got three that are sort of unnamed in terms of distillery. They're just regional, but they're matched, one as an aperitif, one as a dinner whiskey, and one as an after dinner, a smoky, or I think it's called Smoking Ember. And those I haven't tried, those three. But his line of single malts as well are very, very great sounding, and I did have a couple of samples, so I'm looking forward to that. And we're keeping fingers crossed that by this time next year, we're hoping, big surprise, that we'll have the Adelphi bottlings back. We're kind of negotiating on that now, so that's very exciting.
And the venue has gone back to the Palace this year,
we've never
correct?
Been at the Palace. This is the first time.
Okay.
And, yes, that's where we're going to be. It's a beautiful historic hotel. Anybody who's ever been in San Francisco is familiar with it. I think it may be, they may call it the oldest hotel or the most historic or something like that, but it's historically certified, completely renovated, has a phenomenal bar with a huge Maxfield Parrish mural at the back bar, and a great restaurant, great spa, and the ballroom is, you know, just huge and beautiful. We've got two ballrooms and a pre-function area, and then, of course, our breakout rooms for the speakers. It's a great space.
And who will the speakers be this year?
We've got, I'm doing it off the top of my head again. We've got Ian Millar from Grants, who's going to bring his rare collection. Always great speaker. Gordon Wright will be there talking about the new Alchemist line. Lorne McKillop will be speaking for us. I think this is the first time Lorne has been doing a talk for us. He's a little bit shy, and I've always wanted him to do a talk because he is just one of the very great noses in the industry. So I'm looking forward to that. John Glaser back again, just as often as we can get him. We need to have John talk because he just, the room just overflows. He's bringing his new Oak Cross. Have you tried that?
Yes, I have, and it is wonderful
yeah.
as well.
And everything he puts together is like genius. And, you know, he's just won fourth year in a row Innovator of the Year, Whiskey Magazine. And so that's exciting. Let's see, who else? Oh, one of my dearest favorite people, Lincoln Henderson, will be there with the Yamazaki single malts from Japan. And Lincoln, always so fascinating, having crossed over from the bourbon world to the single malt world. And let's see, who else? Well, they're all up on the website. You go to CelticMalts.com and you can check out the whole list, the whole schedule. They're all up there. But it's a great lineup. It always is. I mean, you're hard-pressed in the whiskey world not to have a great lineup.
And are tickets still available?
Yes, we still have tickets. It's a very good-sized venue this year. I'm hoping that we will not sell out until right at showtime. I'm going to hold back several hundred tickets this year and possibly have them for sale at one of the shops in San Francisco. I'm still trying to figure out how to do that because we always have this situation where we do sell out and then people are upset and angry who haven't heard about the show until the last minute because they're visiting in San Francisco or they're there on a convention or whatever. So I'm trying to do that. But we do advise people to buy in advance if at all possible. And ticket sales are very brisk right now.
And your show has something that's unique in the United States, at least, is in that people can actually buy the spirits they're tasting at the festival, correct?
Well, they can't take them away with them.
Okay.
But we were the first show to bring a retailer in, and we've always done that. And the reason they can't take it away is legalities. You're not allowed to walk out of the venue with a bottle of whiskey. It's just against the law. I think that may be the case in most states. But what we do is the retailer has an order list, which people pick up when they check in to the show. They can go through the night. Anything that they sample at the show is available to them to purchase. They go over to the retail table and put in their order, and then they can either pick it up at the retailer's shops or have it sent. So, you know, it's just convenient in any case. And this year, our retailer, I'm so happy to say, is K&L Wine Merchants. And they are just phenomenal, the directress of spirits there. Susan Purnell has always been one of the strongest supporters of the Expo and has just encouraged us in every way, shape, and form. And this is the first year we've brought them in as our retailers, and I'm really excited about it.
By the way, Rhiannon is organizing a new fall event in San Francisco, this festival exclusively for micro-distilleries and independent bottlers. The Independent Spirits Fest will be on October 13th. Tickets go on sale in May. Also coming up in the next few weeks, Whiskey Live Belgium is this coming weekend in Verviers, followed by Celtic Days in Huede, Germany, March 18th through the 25th. The Glenlivet City Links Tour stops in Houston from March 21st through the 30th. Washington, D.C. hosts the Taste D.C. Single Malt Scotch Festival on the 22nd. Whiskey Schiff in Luzern, Switzerland is March 23rd and 24th. And coming up in April, Whiskey Live New York is April 4th, and Malt Advocates Whiskey Fest Chicago is April 13th. If you're looking for a whiskey event, the WhiskeyCast website has events going all the way into 2008 worldwide. Of course, the website address is www.whiskeycast.com. Dr. Jim Swan is best known these days for his work with Penderyn Distillery in Wales, but he's been a behind-the-scenes figure in the whiskey business for years. He's worked with distilleries on ways to improve their product and gets credit for some of the early work on cask finishes. He was also a guest on the very first episode of WhiskeyCast, and I caught up with Jim the other night at a Penderyn tasting in New York City. How did you get started in the distilling business?
I started working when I left university with Arthur D. Little organization, which is an American management consultant business. And we got a project, first of all in beer, and then just after that in whiskey. And it was so successful, a group of us were bought out by the Scotch whiskey industry to do production-led R&D and marketing-related work with them. And that got me started in the whiskey industry. Subsequent to that, a colleague and I bought our own business, our own consultancy in Scotland, and we developed into worldwide wines, beers, the whole range. And after a few years doing that, Penderyn came along, and I got involved in Penderyn. I've got to say I've enjoyed every minute of it. They're lovely people.
Now, give me a list, if you can, of all the distilleries you've worked with, because you've worked with a bunch of guys all over the world, right?
Yeah, well, without going getting permission from all of them, I've worked in virtually all the Scotch whisky distilleries. Only a limited amount with Diageo, but with almost all of the other ones. So we're talking about maybe about 50 distilleries in Scotland that I've actually worked with and in. Nowadays, I work with distillers, a beautiful distillery in Taiwan, which is making absolutely superb quality whisky. I work with them. I work with gin in San Francisco, distillery 209 in San Francisco. We developed a very unique gin. It's distilled on Pier 50. That's gin. I'm involved with vodka with one or two companies as well. I'm involved with rum. I've been doing some absolutely exciting work with Bacardi, who are still a big player in that industry, very big player, and have some very exciting ideas. So, you know, I'm involved all over the world of drinks, and also wines.
Was your family involved in whiskey before, or did you just come to this naturally?
No, I just came to this accidentally. Got the job with Arthur D. Little, and first of all, they got me into a brewing project. They told me I was going in to do that. Then the whiskey one just happened purely by accident. But I tell you this, the whiskey industry is such a wonderful industry, you never want to leave it. We always describe the whiskey industry as gentlemen. Even if they weren't going to give you any business, they would be kind to you, they'd be considerate in a way that many other industries were not quite so gentlemanly. They've always been like that. Penderyn's no different.
Now, this is a fairly typical environment for you in a noisy pub like this, right?
Yes, it is. I'm quite used to being in pubs and shouting to the point that I think I'm going to be hoarse tomorrow. Never am, but anyway, it's nice. It's a great environment to talk to people. And one of the things you'll find, and something not to be abused, but most people, certainly from the whiskey industry, if you talk to them in an environment like this and they've had a few drinks, if they make a promise, they'll never go back in it. Now, I say it's not something to be abused, but it's something to remember.
What is the key ingredient to a whiskey? Is it the barley? Is it the water? Is it the wood? What, in your opinion, really makes a whiskey a whiskey?
I'd have to say two key points, the distillation and the wood. The barley, does make a contribution. The water makes much less contribution than you might think. What you need with water is you need plenty, pure, cold water, and that's it. But the wood is very important. The maturing warehouses bring the best out of the wood, and then putting the blend together and putting into the wood a good distillate, your home and dry. And now the technology exists to do that. Anyone planning to build a distillery can buy into that technology nowadays and be assured of success, whereas 20 years ago, they were taking a big chance.
Now, one of the things you've gotten a lot of credit, or some might say the blame for, is the whole experience and the whole experiment with finishing whiskeys and trying different types of wood to see just what you get. What's your take on this whole subject?
I love the idea of finishing, but and I got to take some blame for it, yeah, because I was involved right at the beginning with Glenmorangie, who were the first to come in out with a modern range of wood finishes, the port wood finish, the sherry wood finish, the Madeira wood finish, and so on. But there's nothing new about finishing, because when maturation first began in the Scotch whisky industry, it was because the wine merchants brought in wine casks. When they were empty, they put the whisky in, and they effectively finished the whisky in wine casks. So it's as old as maturation of whisky itself. All we did was rediscovered it. We reinvented the wheel.
And sort of perfected it.
Yeah. It perfected it, worked with it, and perfected it. But it wasn't new.
One of the questions I was asked this past week, in fact, by a whisky lover, who was trying to figure out which whiskies were representative of the various regions of Scotland. And the feedback I'm getting and giving to him is that it's really not about the regions anymore. It's about the individual profiles.
Yeah, I don't really buy into regions very much. Certainly the Speyside region, the big region in Scotland, is associated with fruity style whiskies and low in peat. But then it all breaks down, because you can get some whiskies in the Highland region which are fruity in as well. You go over to the Isle of Islay, and there are some very peaty whiskies, but then you get Bruichladdich Distillery, which is not peaty, and is still a wonderful whisky and being very successful. So, in all honesty, I don't really buy into the regional story.
And it's almost possible now to create any type of whisky in any environment in Scotland, right?
Yeah. Yes, well, taking the example of Bruichladdich, they decided they wanted to make a peaty whisky, and so sometimes in the year they stop making the ordinary whisky and very carefully make a wonderfully peated whisky, which they call Port Charlotte. And it's extremely good, but it's made in the same distillery. So you can make what you want where you want.
How much of this is a science and how much of it is still an art?
I'd say now it's about 70% of science, but it's still 30% of an art, of deciding. It's like the artist who just knows which colours to put together and the other people who don't. So there's about 30% of that still. And certainly in blending there is. In blending there's a gut feeling for what's going to go with something else.
Now, one of the questions I wanted to ask you about, you're working with some unusual distilleries, first of all. Let's talk about Taiwan and your experiments and your projects there.
Right, okay. Well, the Taiwan distillery is a beautiful distillery. Built by a gentleman who decided he just wanted to have a distillery. He's a very successful businessman, so I'm sure he's not just going to screw up and have a lot of whiskey that's never going to sell. It's not going to happen because it's a very high-quality whiskey. I mean, he wanted a high-quality whiskey, he put the effort behind it, and it's one of the finest new-make whiskies I've come across and been involved in. It's not matured yet, and that's a challenge we have to deal with. But I've no doubt this is going to be a very successful product, because he's put the effort behind it to make it happen.
And you're also working with Kilchoman, right?
Oh, yes. Kilchoman is a very peaty whiskey. It's the kind of opposite end of the spectrum from Penderyn. Big, heavy, peaty whiskey. It's actually the finest of that style of whisky I've ever come across. I do tell the story of getting the first samples off the still, nosing it to give them some tasting notes, and then when I'd finished nosing the new make spirit, tasting it, writing up the notes, I thought, hey, this is darn good stuff, and I sat down and drank it. And it's the first time for many years I've drunk a new make whiskey because it was so good. And I phoned the distillery and said, look, let's change the style of cask. We can go for a more used cask because we've got to let this whiskey come right through. It doesn't need much maturation. And I promise you, when that comes on the market, that's another winner, another real winner.
What, in your opinion, is the sweet spot for a whiskey in terms of aging?
It depends on the whiskey. Totally depends on the whiskey. Penderyn can be ready, right on the 3-year nail mark, but typically Penderyn's ready at its best in about 4.5 years, because it, when it's young, it retains its zest, its fresh, its freshness. Some whiskies need much longer, but what we're finding is as the technology of whiskey improves, we don't need to distill a whiskey which is going to take many, many years to mature. We can have it ready younger. And so you are going to find the age of whiskies will drop, and there's going to be a lot of age labels going to disappear because they're not going to be needed.
You've worked with a lot of distilleries, both startups and existing distilleries. Which is easier, coming into a distillery that already has an established style or starting from scratch like you did at Penderyn?
Oh, starting from scratch is easier because you have more control. When you go into a distillery which already exists, you may want to make changes, but in practice that might be very difficult. But having said that, you can start a distillery which, if you're not careful, you will screw up. There are certain things you've got to do and got to do them correctly. So you still have to be very careful. If you screw up, you're totally to blame for it.
What's the worst example of a screw-up, in your opinion? What would you like to go back and redo if you had a mulligan?
That's a difficult one, because not really had big screw-ups. But there's one which I don't want to name, obviously, where I would have fired the engineer at an earlier stage and got the better one. Because when an engineer puts in something that doesn't cool what you want to set the right level, it's very difficult to handle.
What's your best success then?
The two best successes are Penderyn and Kilholman. The two current ones have been, they're just, to my mind, guaranteed successes. After that, certainly Taiwan one, because the longer you stay in this business, the better you should become. And I feel that is the case in my case, that I'm getting better all the time, you know. I hope. And so Penderyn and Kilholman certainly be wonderful. I think that Taiwan will also be very, very good, and, you know, producing some very good whiskey from that part of the world.
Last question. This is sort of one I ask just about everybody I do these interviews with. A few years from now, when it comes down to that last dram of whiskey that you're ever going to get, which one do you pick out of all the ones you've dealt with and worked with over the years? Which one do you pick for that last dram before you go up to meet your maker?
I'm going to dodge this question because my answer is going to be one of the things I do, I like doing most, is blending. So I'm going to do a unique blend of all the best ones.
And what would your definition of those bests be?
Well, there'll be a fair amount of Penderyn in it. There's maybe going to be about 25% Penderyn in there. There's going to be about 15% of the Taiwan one. There's going to be about 10% of Kilholman, which is going to be big and peaty as a finished product, because normally you just add about 0.5% to 4% of peaty whiskey. And the rest, I think I'd have some from my friends at Brewer Claddock. They make some wonderful whiskey. And I'd need to give some thought to the rest. But some of the really good scotches, some Glenlivet, for example, Macallan, for example, some of these ones would go in there as well to finish it off with. And I'll die happy.
Of course, you'll find a link to Penderyn on the WhiskeyCast website. Finally, I'd like to give you a taste of what's coming up on WhiskeyCast over the next few weeks. With St. Patrick's Day coming up next Saturday, it's a perfect time to talk about Irish whiskies on the next episode. The following week, we'll hear from the original whiskey writer, Michael Jackson. The weekend of March 31st, I'll be at the public opening of George Washington's distillery at the Mount Vernon Estate near Washington. And the week after that, it's Whiskey Live New York. It'll be a fun month, and I hope you'll catch each and every episode. That's all for this edition of WhiskeyCast. Of course, my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. Whiskey Cast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2007, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.